Welcome to International Edition. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington. Ahead, the U.S. and Gulf partners discuss stabilizing the Middle East. Court cases against dozens of political prisoners reportedly being reviewed in Myanmar. Faith leaders urge governments to act on climate change. And the Canadian pop reggae group Magic has a new CD coming out.
Reggae is just attached to me. I can't seem to get bored of it yet. So definitely the reggae is a big part of this album again.
It's right here on The Voice of America. U.S. President Barack Obama and Gulf state leaders are meeting in Riyadh on ways they can work more closely to help stabilize the conflict-ridden Middle East region, despite some differences on the best way forward. White House correspondent Mary Alice Salinas is traveling with the president and joins us on the line from Riyadh. Welcome, Mary Alice.
Well, thank you very much, Susan. It's good to be with you.
Thank you. What does the U.S. hope to accomplish at this summit?
Well, they are looking for ways that they can agree on more and work together on more things in the Middle East. That's very broad, but generally it's, you know, there's some disagreement about how to approach all the chaos and all the political uncertainty and the way things are happening in the Middle East right now. They have different priorities, different ways of approaching how they should handle it. And so right now they're actually just discussing ways that they can work more closely. And that is the great hope here, that this dialogue continues. There will probably be some announcements afterwards on how they've deepened cooperation. Also, some military assistance from the U.S., which is really important to the Gulf states. But beyond that, not a whole lot more, other than to continue the dialogue.
One concern is the fight against the Islamic State.
That is a key priority for the United States. That is, there are three sessions. One is regional security, how they can work together more closely. The second session is really important, especially for the United States, and that is combating Islamic State and Al-Qaeda. The U.S. would like more cooperation and help from Arab states on that. The U.S. sees that as a top priority, not just for the U.S., but for global security. So a lot of the Arab states are more concerned about Iran and its actions in the region and sectarian wars, sectarian conflicts. And that's what they're worried about. To many of the Gulf states, that's the global priority. That's the key priority, the key security threat. So the second session will focus on what U.S. views as the greater threat, and that is Al-Qaeda and Islamic State. Now, the final session on this day will be on Iran, and that addresses, of course, the concerns of many of the Arab states.
And those concerns are?
Well, they're concerned that Iran continues to build up its military capabilities, continues missiles testing, continues to back many of the rebels in the region that are causing chaos and political failures, like in Yemen. That is a key example. Tehran backing the Houthis. So Saudi Arabia went in there with some costly military power to combat the Houthis. Stems back to the regional rivalry between the Sunni majority Saudis and the Shia majority Iranians, the proxy war. So that's the big concern here. And these are all neighbors. So they view that as the greater threat and the more immediate threat to them. So all the very complex issues, a lot to tackle in one day. But I think the U.S. position is that this is a good time to address this because there are some fragile ceasefires right now in Yemen and also in Syria. The U.S. would like to see more of the focus on those, turn to the political process to continue to stabilize those states, and then more focus go to Islamic State and Al-Qaeda.
Thank you very much, Mary Alice, for speaking with us from Riyadh.
My pleasure, Susan, anytime.
And now we go to a happier topic because my social media reporter, Andrew Palchevsky, has joined us to talk about the Queen and her birthday. Happy birthday, Queen.
Happy birthday to Queen Elizabeth. She turns 90 today. And
yes.
So there are celebrations all over the world.
And she looks good for
90. She looks good for 90. A lot of people noting that on social media. Happy birthday, Your Majesty, is actually the top trending worldwide hashtag
wow,
right now as people
impressive.
Wish her a happy birthday. So a lot of celebrations in the UK and also around the world. Everybody's pulling out their photos of when they met the Queen or, you know, favorite photos of the Queen from her reign and from her 90 years. But no one is immune to criticism, not even Queens, not even on their birthday. So people are saying, you know, oh, happy birthday, Your Majesty. It's time, you know, the monarchy ends and those kind of things. So people are seizing on that. But
somebody has to spoil everything.
Somebody has to spoil everything. But by and large, it's a, you know, it seems to be a happy birthday on social media.
Well, I hope she knows how popular she is, that she's trending.
I think she does. I think they have some people that keep her abreast of what's going on social media. And certainly today, you know, Your Majesty, you're trending. You know, I'm sure it's someone's job to go say that. But the other trending topic today is the Time 100. Time magazine releases a list every year of the 100 most influential people in the world.
I take it I wasn't listed there.
I didn't see your name. I'll double check, but I didn't see neither yours nor mine. But, you know, some names that we will recognize. Mark Zuckerberg, of course, the CEO of Facebook. Some big entertainers like Adele and Nicki Minaj. Donald Trump making the list. Priyanka Chopra making the list. She's a Bollywood star. She actually gets one of the six covers that they have with some of the Time 100 people. But also we see people like Dr. Denis Mukwege, who is working with rape survivors in the Democratic Republic of Congo. So it's highlighting a lot of people, not just celebrities, but people who are doing really good work around the world. And it's interesting, too, that they have famous people write these descriptions and write these little things in Time magazine. So we have, you know, for Adele, actress Jennifer Lawrence wrote up her little tidbit about her. And for Dr. Mukwege, it was actually Dr. Jill Biden, the vice president's wife.
Yes.
So it's almost, you know, as big as the names that are on the list are the people who are writing their little blurbs about
them. That's very interesting, Andrew. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Okay. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
The LIGO Scientific Collaboration announced the first detection of gravitational waves that pass through our planet on September 14, 2015. The waves of energy that traveled for 1.3 billion years were produced by the merger of two black holes. NASA scientists say that less than a half second after the gravitational waves rocked the fabric of space-time, the Fermi Gamma Ray Space Telescope was able to detect a quick and weak pulse of high-energy light from the same area of space. NASA says this would be a remarkable discovery since mergers of black holes are thought to happen without producing any kind of light. While their analysis indicates that this burst of energy has just a 0.2% chance of being coincidence, the scientists say they'll need additional observations before they can firmly associate spurts of high-energy X-rays with gravitational waves from black hole mergers. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
The spokesperson for the office of Myanmar President Thin Jha has told VOA officials are reviewing the court cases against dozens of political prisoners in a bid to drop all charges. Jha Hatte said the cases being reviewed involve peaceful activities based on freedom of expression, not criminal or violent activities. State counselor and Nobel laureate Aung San Suu Kyi has vowed to push for the release of political prisoners and student activists held under previous military-backed governments. As many as 200 detainees may be involved. About 200 have already been pardoned. Vikram Nehru, the Bakari Chair in Southeast Asian Studies at the Washington-based Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, told VOA's Victor Beatty via Skype, "It is impressive to see how quickly the National League for Democracy, or NLD-dominated government, is moving on the issue."
You know, it started on April the 9th when they, in fact, released 113, and then the president very recently announced the release of another 83, though apparently only 63 have been released so far. And now there's this additional effort to try and release the remaining political prisoners who have been put in prison for peaceful protests against the previous administration, for protesting against land grabs and that sort of thing. So it's very encouraging to see how fast the NLD administration is moving on this.
Vikram, who are these people?
People like journalists, peasants, workers, union activists, people who were carrying out peaceful protests against the administration, against what they saw as being local injustices. So, for example, peasants who came together to protest against land grabs, or union activists who protested against the conditions in garment factories, or journalists, for example, who may have been critical about the way religion was being used to incite violence. So these were, frankly, actions taken by people that would in other countries have gone almost unnoticed, or at least would have been considered perfectly appropriate and legal. But in Myanmar, unfortunately, they were imprisoned. And I think now those wrongs are being righted, and that's a good thing.
Will this end the issue of political prisoners in Myanmar?
They may be. It's difficult to tell, but some people have raised concerns that there are some ethnic political prisoners who really should be released. That's difficult to tell without actually reviewing the individual cases. What's very interesting is that the Myanmar Human Rights Commission is reviewing each and every case and making sure that those who are being released are those who have not really committed any criminal acts or acts of violence. That's the first point. And secondly, what's also quite encouraging is that it's the Myanmar police who will eventually drop the charges against these prisoners, which means that the Minister for Home Affairs, under whom the police operate, and who is, in fact, an army-appointed person and is from the army, Cho Swe, is cooperating with the NLD administration. So that is a very encouraging sign as well.
Vikram Nehru welcomes the announcement by Aung San Suu Kyi that she will press for greater autonomy for Myanmar's ethnic minorities, groups that have been fighting previous governments in Myanmar, also known as Burma, for years. But he says he awaits a renewed dialogue and ceasefire talks. He says the new NLD government is putting people in place in the cabinet and parliament who are sympathetic to Myanmar's minority groups. Coming up on International Edition, the movement to save Mother Earth and a new pop reggae CD to look forward to. On Earth Day, Friday, April 22nd, world leaders come together to sign the Global Climate Change Agreement negotiated in Paris in December. The ceremony at United Nations headquarters in New York marks the first step in the ratification process. As VOA's Roseanne Skirbel reports, a few days earlier, a contingency of faith leaders issued a statement that expressed solidarity with the pact and the need for rapid action to put it into force.
Religious and lay leaders joined in prayer at the chapel of the Church Center for the United Nations. They affirmed the sanctity of the earth. They came to deliver an interfaith climate statement to the president of the UN General Assembly. 250 eminent faith leaders, including the Dalai Lama and South African social rights activist Desmond Tutu, had signed the document, which urges heads of state to quickly sign, ratify, and implement the Paris Climate Agreement. Some 5,000 individuals and 90 groups worldwide also signed the statement. Fletcher Harper is executive director of Green Faith, an interfaith coalition that helped organize the event. He says the statement reflects spiritual and moral values shared by all traditions.
We must regard the earth as a gift, not just as a commodity that can be bought or sold, but as a gift that must be cherished and protected, not only for short-term economic gain, but for the long-term protection of life.
In the UN chapel, faith leaders stepped forward to express solidarity with the climate statement. Among them was Karen Bally, global chairperson for the United Religions Initiative, the largest global interfaith organization, which is active in 94 countries. She calls the worsening droughts, food shortages, and species extinctions made worse by climate change a human and spiritual failure.
And I'm here to ask for everybody to unite, to come together as people of faith who believe in the values of oneness and respect, environmental stewardship, and really save our planet, save our earth.
Faith leaders called on governments to move from fossil fuels to renewable energy sources. This would help curb warming emissions and keep temperature rise below 2 degrees Celsius compared with pre-industrial times. 80% of the world's population identify with a religious tradition, says Harper, who is also an Episcopal minister. He says those communities are in a unique position to push a new climate agenda.
by mobilizing the support and the commitment of these communities on climate change, we have a chance to transform the cultures of the world, and by transforming the cultures, transform politics, so that government leaders understand that they absolutely must take dramatic action on climate change now.
Then Stephen Chu of the Buddhist Tzu Chi Foundation handed the Interfaith Climate Statement to the UN General Assembly President, who promised to deliver it to member states.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Accompanied by a Sikh prayer song, the crowd left, more determined than ever to translate their words into action. Roseanne Skirbel, VOA News, Washington.
U.S. Treasury Secretary Jack Lew has called it an exciting moment to announce that 19th century abolitionist Harriet Tubman will appear on the front of the $20 bill, the first African-American to be so honored. Lew said it is the first in a series of steps to redesign American currency.
Harriet Tubman is one of the great American stories. A woman born a slave, illiterate for her whole life. She brought many, many people out of slavery through the Underground Railroad by time and again risking her own life to save others. She did intelligence for our army during the Civil War. After she worked to get the women's suffrage movement going. It's a great American story about how if you care about our democracy, it doesn't matter where you come from and it doesn't matter what you started out with, you can change our country. We're also going to be changing the 5 and the 10. And on the back of the 10, we're going to tell the story of women's suffrage more generally, with the leaders of the suffrage movement and a demonstration on the steps of the Treasury building for the women's right to vote. And on the back of the 5, we're going to bring to life the Lincoln Memorial with iconic events that have really changed our country.
Lew said the target date for the redesigns, which will employ the most modern anti-counterfeit technology, is 2020. 100th anniversary of women's suffrage in the U.S., and circulation will begin after that. The redesigned $10 bill will feature several female leaders on the back, including suffrage movement leaders Sojourner Truth and Elizabeth Cady Stanton, while the nation's first Treasury Secretary, Alexander Hamilton, will remain on the front. The $5 bill will still have President Abraham Lincoln on the front, with former First Lady Eleanor Roosevelt and civil rights leader Martin Luther King Jr. on the back. Women have only twice before been featured on U.S. currency, the wife of the nation's first president, Martha Washington, and Native American, Pocahontas, in the 1800s. This is VOA.
From science and technology, here's what's new.
What's new? It's called the Happy Slide. It's in Shanghai, China. It's 54 meters long. It's 20 meters high. It's an amusement slide. People who have tested the Happy Slide may quibble with the happy part, like Liu Le, for instance.
I was really scared because during those bends, my hands felt numb.
And it wasn't any better for Liu Shenwei.
I felt terrified, especially at the bends.
Liu Haiying, one of the ride's designers, says the happy slide isn't all that bad. As a matter of fact, she says it's not scary enough.
It gets lots of fun. I'm not scared at all. Sometimes I even think it isn't exciting enough.
Only people between the ages of 7 and 50 and in good health may use the happy slide. The slide can be found in the New World Department Store Mall in Shanghai's Pudong District, and visitors can load up on all the terror they can stand because the happy slide is free. For VOA's What's New, I'm Todd Grossons.
The Canadian pop reggae group Magic will have a new CD coming out July 1st, Primary Colors. It's the band's second CD after their first effort, Don't Kill the Magic, peaked at number 6 on the Billboard album charts. International Edition's David Byrd reports the group is hoping Primary Colors will keep fans bouncing along.
Their first CD vaulted Magic to stardom with its smash hit, Rude. The record spent 6 weeks at number 1 on the Billboard Hot 100. It sold 3.3 million downloads and had 313 million on-demand streams, according to Nielsen Music. That's a tough act to follow. But band leader Nasri Atwe says that he hopes Primary Colors doesn't fall under the sophomore curse, where a second album doesn't do as well as the first.
Do you know what? Like,
I kind of, at first, when people ask me the pressure, I was like, no, I feel no pressure. I'm a rock. But, you know, I got this personality trait from my mother, which is like the worry bone, you know. I'm kind of a worrier. And yeah, of course I worried about it, you know, and I worry about it because I don't want to stop.
Attway and his writing partner, Adam Messinger, had success writing for other acts like Justin Bieber and Shakira. He formed Magic 4 years ago with guitarist Mark Pelizer, bassist Ben Spivak, and drummer Alex Tanis. Though the group has experimented with other genres, their infectious reggae sound is what brought them to stardom. Attway says that's a reflection of his love for the island-flavored music.
I'm pretty impatient, you know, with you know, sticking to one thing, but reggae is just attached to me. I can't seem to get bored of it yet. So definitely the reggae is a big part of this album again. And then there's this other side of it. There's this kind of little 80s vibe to some of the songs, too. That's a lot of fun. There's a song called Gloria. That's about this like cheating girl named Gloria. Fictional story. A lot of fun. You know, I call it Magic meets ABBA.
I'm trying to lay you down easy. Check me out, girl. I'm at the magic floor. Check my word. Now I know you don't.
For Primary Colors, Attway integrated the sounds of rapper Sean Paul. The first single, Lay You Down Easy, debuted at number one on the Billboard Reggae Digital Songs chart. Its official music video is closing in on 1.5 million global views on YouTube. The 35-year-old Attway says that for Primary Colors, the band didn't want to rest on its previous success with Rude.
It was like everything. It was like having, even with relationships, you know, like, hey, we should start over right from scratch, Primary Colors, and mix again. Or even creatively, like going back to basics, just writing a pop song instead of like overthinking it. Let's mix the basics. And it just was kind of like the through line. And it sounds cool, you know, to me.
Nasri Attway says Primary Colors also features what he calls urban folk and a tune he describes as reggae Coldplay. Primary Colors is set for release July 1st. In Washington, I'm David Byrd.
We would like to invite you to follow us on Twitter. You can find us at @VOA_IE. If you would like to listen to today's program again or any previous broadcast, please visit our website at voanews.com. Go to the Programs tab in the upper right-hand corner, then scroll down to International Edition. Thanks for joining us.
Next, an international public service announcement by the United States government.
Jamal Mohammed al-Badawi is a fugitive who was wanted in connection with the October 2000 attack on the USS Cole, a U.S. naval vessel moored at the time in the harbor of Aden, Republic of Yemen. A Yemeni native, al-Badawi is a small man, standing 5'5" tall with black hair and dark eyes, and weighs about 175 pounds. He is 48 years old and also known as Jamal Mushin al-Tali, Abu Abdal Rahman al-Adani, and Jamal Mohammed Ahmad. The attack on the USS Cole resulted in the deaths of 17 American sailors. For this and other actions, al-Badawi is charged with murder, conspiracy to use weapons of mass destruction, providing material support for terrorist groups, and other crimes. He was being held by Yemeni authorities in connection with the attack when he escaped in April 2003. He was recaptured the next year, but escaped again in February 2006. The Rewards for Justice program is offering a reward of up to $5 million for information leading to al-Badawi's arrest or prosecution. The U.S. guarantees that all reports will be investigated and the identity of all informants will be kept confidential. If appropriate, the U.S. is prepared to protect informants by relocating them. If you have information on this man, contact the Regional Security Office at the nearest U.S. Embassy and the tip line at www.rewardsforjustice.net or email information to rfj@state.gov.
That was an international public service announcement by the United States government.